This is the Benson at 100, a podcast from the Nettie Lee Benson Latin American Collection at the University of Texas at Austin. The Benson is one of the world's most storied libraries. During this, our centennial year, we explore the people, archives, and collections that built this library. Learn more at benson100.org. That's benson100.org. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. Welcome to the Benson at 100 podcast. Today we have the pleasure of interviewing Dr. Cesar Salgado. Salgado is professor at the Department of Spanish and Portuguese at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also the graduate advisor in the program of comparative literature, also at the University of Texas. He's a specialist in Caribbean literature. And today, we want to talk to him about a very important archive that is in the Nettie Lee Benson Latin American Collection. We are referring to the archive of Cuban writer Eliseo Diego, acquired in 2019. Cesar, welcome to our podcast about the Benson Library. So can we start with you telling us a little bit about Eliseo Diego, who he was, and also what can you tell us about his literary career?
Okay. Well, Eliseo Diego is a poet born in Cuba in 1920, and we, 2 years ago, celebrated his centennial. And as part of that centennial, which actually happened, you know, concurrently, in a way, with the Benson Collection centennial, we arranged both the acquisition of his papers, which are now housed at the Nettie Lee Benson Collection, and also an international conference that incorporated colleagues from the Colegio de Mexico as part of the all the events and the presentations. So he, Eliseo Diego is a revered poet throughout Latin America. People have compared him to T.S. Eliot. He has a poetic ethos and style that reminds us a lot of Borges' own poetry, Jorge Luis Borges. He's known to be the favorite poet of a lot of well-known writers, such as García Márquez, who actually was very close to his family, both in Cuba and in Mexico. Eliseo Diego was part of perhaps one of the most outstanding generations or circles of writers, the Orígenes group. He was also part of a family of creators. His wife, Bella, was the sister of Fina García Marrús, who in turn was married to Cintio Vitier. And that family, which with their children, who actually became very well, in fact, are still very well known writers, musicians, and artists, were sort of the core of what people call La Familia de Orígenes, the Orígenes family. So the values related to the family. Also, there's a religiosity that's part of Eliseo's concerns, as well as many other Orígenes members, not all of them. And it created a very interesting dynamic of literary accomplishment that was both very much concerned about the Cuban spirit and about being able to transcend the challenges of political challenges and cultural challenges of Cuba during the 20th century, but also was aspiring to make a contribution to world literature, to attain a stature of quality of an attention that would be fully cosmopolitan at the same time that they were fully Cuban.
Absolutely. That's super interesting. I was hoping you could tell us a little bit more about this group, Orígenes, because Diego was one of the main founders of it. Who were some of the other names in this group that we might know or might hear? And if you could talk a little bit more about some of the goals of Orígenes, the movements within the group of Orígenes maybe too.
Well, Cuba has an exceptional literary history. And it's really remarkable to see since, you know, the 18th century, since Espejo de Paciencia, even a century before that, how literature has been an instrument for decolonization, for trying to increase sovereignty in a context that has very terrible legacies of colonialism, slavery, economic subservience to empires. So literature has been an important tool for redemption. and for liberation and for social justice, and also for aesthetics as a way of being able to establish an identity, right? To really sort of be able to stake your own terrain. And Orígenes was part of that tradition. People think of the Orígenes group as a sort of a post-avant-garde sort of moment. They sort of coalesced in essentially during the Second World War. So it's after the avant-garde moment that in Cuba was represented by the Generación Avance, with people like Jorge Mañach, right, and Alejo Carpentier, they actually sort of took a different position that was very much informed by Christian humanism at the time. There was people were sort of stepping back from the extreme experimentalism, sort of radicalness of the avant-garde, essentially at a moment of world conflict, which sort of resonates when we have a war in Ukraine. How we could find a sort of universal humanism might sort of sound a little bit overreaching, but they were seeking a sort of way through Catholicity, is the term that they use, so that they could actually propose a way of being able to save the world from itself in the context of war. I mean, that's the way in which I think Orígenes sort of proceeded. That's why they valued, religious humanism as part of what some of them were doing. We think of the core of Orígenes sort of coalescing around that that agenda. José Lezama Limas being the leader, famous Baroque Catholic gay writer. Mm-hmm. So the question of being able to find within the Catholic spectrum space, right, for alternative sexuality was something that was very big for Lezama, not that big for other members. But then again, there's Fina García Marrús and Cintia Vitier, who actually, as part of their Christian humanism, they actually moved towards liberation theology and actually embraced the Cuban Revolution as committed Christians. So that was one sort of aspect, one legacy of the Grupo Orígenes. But then again, there were other Orígenistas who Lezama also embraced because of how Lezama was very much believe in sort of being able to rescue whatever was heterodox or actually was part of the heretic tradition of Catholicism. So he embraced Virgilio Piñera, he embraced Lorenzo García Vega, who were declared atheists, right? And they created this very dynamic sort of group of writers with very interesting ideological tensions between them, but coalescing around this sort of circle, because they actually had a system of socialization. And at the same time, they published one of the most reputed literary journals in the history of the language. So this is basically the dynamics in which Eliseo Diego found himself. He was an outstanding poet. In a way, he might be the most popular Orígenes poet in the group. Even more so than Fina García Marrús, who's actually, really absolutely recognized with the Reina Sofía Prize and many other acknowledgments. But Eliseo Diego got the Juan Rulfo Prize, right, in 1993. And 1 week after that, I met him in Havana. Oh, just after, wow. After the prize was announced, when I was doing research on my book on Lezama Lima and Joyce. So I got to know Eliseo Diego. He died the year after, in 1994 in Mexico. So I wasn't able to extend that acquaintance, but I was able to meet the rest, many of his children. I became a friend of Lichi, Liceo Alberto, and of Fefe, of Josefina. Josefina participated in our conference, and she's an important interlocutor. And thanks to her, and to a great extent, is why we have his papers at the Benson Collection.
And of course, we're mentioning these names because they figure prominently in the Eliseo Diego papers that we have at the Benson. So folks could come in and see, for instance, correspondence between Diego and Lezama Lima as an example. And so that's why it's important to talk about these names not only within the context of Diego, but within the context of the collection, I think. So for me, of the names that are in the collection, of the names that you're naming, I want to circle back to Lezama Lima for a minute because, selfishly, because he played an important part on my academic career, both the good and the bad. I remember reading La Expresión Americana, and I found a copy at a bookstore in Santa Fe, New Mexico once, and I covet it to this day. I cling to that book. To me, it was a revelation to read La Expresión Americana, this idea of the Baroque or the neo-Baroque as a contraconquista, no, like a counter-conquest. After I read that, I read Paradiso, and I don't know that I had an adverse reaction to it, but it was one of those books. I don't know that I had much of a reaction to it because it was one of those books where I read five or six pages, and I would say, what the heck did I just read? I'm not a native Spanish speaker. I was reading it in Spanish because I think there's value in doing that. But essentially, I thought it was the most complicated text of my life to try to navigate this book, Paradiso, where, you know, for me, Lezama Lima's literature is really playing out in this book, the way he thinks about description, the way he thinks about detail, the idea of the Baroque pearl, and the multiple layers of the Baroque. And so is that how the Baroque or neo-Baroque is? Is that how you view it? Maybe you could talk a little bit about that or how you might teach a text like Paradiso. And maybe, I don't want to give you too many questions at once, but maybe how Eliseo Diego might differ from some of those ideas as well. And you can take one of those and go with it however you wish.
Well, I have been teaching Lezama for throughout my career. I'm best known as a Lezamista.
Sure.
And I participated in many congresses and have a number of recognitions from Cuba about that work.
Sure.
So, Paradiso, I think it's really a masterpiece of the language. You know, my book actually compares it to the works of James Joyce in terms of the aesthetics of difficulty. You know, remember that La Expresión Americana starts with that famous sentence, solo lo difícil es estimulante, only right. That which is difficult really can stimulate you, can provoke
Absolutely.
You, can get you to the next stage, right? And the question of the Baroque as a means to be able to approach complexity, to be able to account for complexity, to be able to use complexity, and to be able to live within complexity is fundamental. Paradiso is an extraordinary novel. The thing that makes it singular, among many other things, is that it is a long prose poem. Lezama was mostly a poet. Essentially, his vision of the world was based on the image. So the layeredness of the discourse happens to be that it functions at many at different levels. People have tried to account. Essentially, each sentence of Paradiso is a novel to itself, and it opens. I say that Borges wrote a story called El Aleph.
Of course.
The Aleph, which actually was about that point in the universe that actually show that one point in which the whole universe is condensed and you can look at the universe. For Lezama, a word was the Aleph. You know, the thing about sort of being able to travel the suggestions that a word that you might hear out in the street, un grito en la calle, and the potentials of the novels that are implied, right, within that word that suddenly sort of catches your attention. Mm-hmm. Essentially, that was Lezama's universe, and it's a unique notion of interconnections through culture and the power of language. That, you know, the fact that Joyce and Lezama were both, you know, Catholic and sort of had to think about the idea of the word world, the world as word. And and that tradition of the fecit, of the word that actually produces language that produces the world, language that is the basis of the creation of the world, godly language that came before the very creation itself, has to do with that complexity. So that's one way of approaching it.
Sure.
One thing that I would say, is that, Lezama used to say that he wrote this family novel, because it's a family novel. It's novel among other things, it's a history of Cuba. It's a poetic theory of the world. It's an autobiography. It's a treatise about American culture, because it is also the literary archive, or rather, it's sort of like the counterpart to the Archive of Orígenes, because Lezama produced Paradiso after he was done with a journal. When he was done with a journal, then he wrote La Expresión Americana, and after writing La Expresión Americana, he said, "I need to finish my novel." So the novel is sort of like a condensation, a summa, he called it, right, of all these other of his poetry, of his work as a cultural entrepreneur, as an editor of Orígenes, and as an author of all these essays about literary culture and literary history. So how do we situate Eliseo there against this grandeur, you know, this monumental accomplishment of Lezama? Lezama used to say that he wrote Paradiso because Eliseo Diego did not write his family novel. When the first review that Lezama wrote of Eliseo's first book, it was a collection of stories. He said that there's a novel here about the Cuban family, and you know essentially we need this novel. No? Que vengan las imágenes, because Lezama thought that literature was a redeeming tool for culture. So you could save a country writing a novel. And he essentially wanted Eliseo to write the novel. But Eliseo became a very good poet. He actually produced in La Casada de Jesús del Monte, and that was the novel, right? And Lezama said, well, since he went and did his poetry, let me then just try the novel. So there's that connection, you know, and there's a dedication. That Lezama says, since you didn't get to write the novel, I decided to do it. And here's Paradiso. Beautiful. So in a way, Eliseo Diego is at the moment of conception of Paradiso.
So to follow up, and speaking of the genre that Daniel mentioned, neo-baroque, did the writers of Orígenes have a common aesthetic or shared characteristics that you can explain to
me? No, this is one of the most outstanding features of the Orígenes circle and of Lezama as mentor, as maestro, is that the Orígenes circle did not have a unified aesthetic at all. I mean, if you read Eliseo Diego, you need to wonder what was his connection with Lezama Lima, because Eliseo, maybe he was Baroque in the sense of being a conceptual artist that works with a lot of economy and condensation, like Quevedo could do. He wasn't a gongorista. Lezama was a really luxurious writer that was based on accumulation. Eliseo Diego actually is based on elimination, and it's really he has a lot of economy. He really, if you look at his drafts, basically what you see are cross outs. Right? He's actually sort of trying to condense. He uses silence a lot. Silence is very important for him. And in Lezama, I've worked with Lezama's manuscript, and I don't see any tachadura. Essentially, it's just this sort of marejada, no, sort of like a wave of ideas that basically are sort of inundating the page, right? And Eliseo moves in a very different direction, but he's still very much informed by a Baroque mindset, right? Which is a very complex one as well. I mean, that's one of my, I teach a course on Baroque and neo-Baroque genealogies. And the Baroque is a style, the remarkable idea of Lezama, sort of seeing the American Baroque as the arte de la contraconquista, an art that actually wants to counter the wounds of the conquest, that wants to heal, right, the genocide of the conquest, and try to use very subtle ways, using theology itself, using the iconology of the Baroque, and being able to achieve cultural survival through this camouflage. It's a very good thesis about why you have Santeria and how the cult of the Orishas was able to survive through the system of the saints in the Catholic Church, and that doubleness, right, in which you actually have a cosmology that is surviving through the signs of another cosmology. I mean, that's the American Baroque, according to Lezama, and that's where the counter-conquest comes, right? And for that, you need, it's basically this sort of surplus of signs and being able to manage different sign systems and bind them together according to this sort of superabundance. Lezama spoke about sobreabundancia, and he got that from Góngora, from that type of poetics, which he really sort of took off from that for Paradiso. The Eliseo works in a different direction. You know, he goes for the suggestion. He really pares down. You know, his poems are short for the most part. He didn't sort of he doesn't have a Muerte de Narciso, sort of immense sort of long poems, but he actually was working on very conceptual ideas. Some of them that had to do with desengaño, with disillusionment, with understanding that the world consists of illusions, right, and being able to pierce through those illusions, and sort of coming to terms with a degraded world, with a world after the fall, which is tremendously Catholic. I mean, during the Reformation, that was used for my control in a big way. But Eliseo had a true sort of sense of the fallenness of the world, and part of Eliseo's biography and part of the magic of his poetry. And part of his career had to do that he found that type of, he had a taste of paradise. He had a confirmation of paradise in his childhood. And because of a number of reasons, he was expelled from that Eden, right, from that paradise. It had to do with a very complex family history because his father was not acknowledged by the mother's side of the family. So there was a compensatory aspect there that actually the being expelled from paradise had to do with his father sort of being expelled from the, being not recognized by the family, by his mother's family. So that sense of trying to recover a sense of wellness and a sense of paradise by being able to go back to memories of childhood is across Eliseo's work, and it explains why he was so devoted to children's literature throughout his life. He trained as a teacher, sort of late in his life in the 50s, and part of his contributions to the Cuban Revolution was that he led the children's section of the National Library for about 10 years until he was. He changed his jobs and went to work for the Writers Union and by the 1970s. But he actually led the children's room for that time, and he actually continued writing about children's literature, translating poetry for children. He translated the Winnie the Pooh in Spanish that's still unpublished, among other things. So he was an expert on children's literature, and it's part of his poetics.
So we were talking earlier before we started recording about Eliseo Diego's anglophilia or his affinity with the English language. Yes. And he spoke English very well. And you mentioned that he worked as an English teacher for the Ministry of Education after the revolution. So can you go a little bit more in depth about his role in the revolutionary government now that you mentioned that he worked on?
Well, his connection to English was as deep and as complex as Jorge Luis Borges. And part of that had to do that his mother, who was part of a Creole landowning, you know, sort of a more or less, you know, well-placed, I wouldn't say aristocratic sort of strata, but, you know, they were well-settled people. She was an inspector of English schools during Batista, right? And she taught Eliseo English. And basically, you know, if you actually go to Eliseo's apartment in the Vedado, where now Fefe lives, or his daughter Josefina lives, essentially the library is a library of books in English for the most part. I mean, there's of course he has classics from Spain and Latin America, of course, but essentially he was a devoted reader of English, and he and that had to do with his own training. He went to the United States. When you actually look at his translations, you know, the vast majority of them are from the English language. He read especially high modernist writers, but actually sort of harking back to the 18th century English tradition, especially British and Irish writers, right? I remember my conversation with him about James Joyce. He was able to recite the Villanelle from the Portrait of the Artist by heart. He has great essays about Huxley. He was a great reader of Virginia Woolf. So he, many of the lessons that he found in the economy of English literary language, he tried to bring that into his own poetry and also in his essays. So he had that. And as you say, he gave conferences on English literature. He actually sort of was able to write on that and to teach in the Revolution. But one thing that is really remarkable is that when he was recruited by Nicolás Guillén to work at the Unión de Escritores y Artistas de Cuba, he had a moment in which he traveled three times to the Soviet Union, and he was part of a team that actually was working on the translation of Slavic poetry into Spanish, and it's remarkable to see how that's part of his epistolary, the letters to the poets when he's writing back home, right, to Bella especially, about his impressions of the Soviet Union, right, and the. And how, you know, how the whole bureaucratic sort of experience there, and the fact that he was able to find poetry there, right, and that he was also embraced in that role is really significant, and people have not remarked on that. People think of him as somebody who worked with mostly British literatures in terms of what was his foundation from the point of view of world literature, but he had a moment in which he was very active in Cuba, Soviet literary exchanges, and that's very well documented in the materials that we have at the Benson Collection.
It's super interesting. I mean, we've mentioned James Joyce now a few times, and it seems like he's always had this important impact on what I've always kind of termed post-plantation writers, right? I'm thinking of Garcia Marquez to Edward Glissant from the Francophone Caribbean as well. And so it's interesting to see these sort of dialogues.
Walcott.
Exactly.
Also,
yeah.
Also. Well, you know, besides Lezama, I have my work on Joyce.
Sure.
So you can look at it. I've worked on Joyce as well and his impact on Latin America. And that's something that that's something I have plenty to say.
Absolutely.
To talk about, but that's for a different sort of moment.
Sure, sure. I do want to circle back. You mentioned briefly that Diego was a librarian. And of course, as a librarian, my ears perked up. Can you tell us more about that part of his life?
Oh, there's some remarkable things to say about that. And and it has to do with a very complex relation that Eliseo Diego had with his country and with the Cuban Revolution too. Many of the people in the Orígenes group were marginalized in the early years of the revolution because of they maintained their Catholic convictions,
sure.
And it took a while for the authorities to sort of welcome them or find a place for them, listen to them. Allow them to re-enter the sphere of cultural production. Lezama was marginalized at the end of his life. when Paradiso came out, which was a very controversial book, it was a miracle that it was published right at the time of the UMAP. So when a lot of persecution against people, you know, favoring sexual freedom, were being persecuted. So they found refuge in some spaces, right? Lezama was recognized because of his stature, so that he was named vice president of the UNEAC for some time. It didn't last, you know, that long. And some of the Indigenistas, the most sort of more conventionally Catholic, found refuge in the Biblioteca Nacional. The director actually found their places, and Cintia Vitier, Fina Garcia Marruz, and Eliseo Diego worked at the Biblioteca Nacional as researchers, as librarians, as bibliographers. And there's plenty to say about what they accomplished there. One first is Eliseo sort of taking over the children's section, right? And organizing that, his lectures, we have them. We have the drafts. We have his annotations. We have his list of purchase list of books that was needed to actually have a good children's section. He was beloved because from the way that he reached out for children and the sort of twinkle in the eye that he had when he was sort of dealing with questions of childhood and trying to recover that kingdom. Right, that he saw as the announcement of the possibility of there being a heaven. Right, that's basically part of his poetic vision. But he trained people as well, and he, you know, I want to write something about this very, very substantially. One of the people that he discovered was Reinaldo Arenas.
Oh wow!
The Reinaldo Arenas was he was a bumpkin from Holguín, who was brought to Havana so that he could sort of become an agrimensor. And train, but for some reason he was at the Biblioteca Nacional when they were having it was sort of like a theatrical event, a contest, and people were invited. He was very young. People were invited to recite a Christmas story, and Reinaldo Arenas was there, and he was reciting a Christmas story. Cynthia Vitier and Eliseo Diego were part of the jury. And Arenas actually came up with a story of his own. And when Eliseo Diego heard that story, he said, you know, we need to give this guy a job here. We need to keep him here. Eliseo Diego became his mentor. He gave, you know, essentially Reinaldo Arenas' preference for Virginia Woolf is something that he got from Eliseo. If you actually look at, there's a number of homages that you see across Reinaldo Arenas' work referencing Virginia Woolf, Orlando in particular, which was a key work for him. So we have and we have the first novel, no, that Reinaldo Arenas wrote, Celestino antes del alba. Mm-hmm. It is within the parameters of rescuing a childhood from the perspective of Eliseo Diego, but rather than rescuing the paradise of childhood, he rescues the inferno of childhood, because he had such a traumatic childhood that he couldn't sort of redeem it, right, and sort of give this sense of a sort of a Eden-like type of splendor which Eliseo could do. So he had to sort of flip it and sort of give us one of the best representations of childhood as inferno that we ever have in the history of the Spanish language. And that was because of Eliseo's mentorship at the Biblioteca Nacional, at the library.
Right.
So speaking of libraries, so let's talk about the collection at the Benson. Daniel, can you give us an overview of what it contains?
Sure. I'll do a brief overview, and I'll start by saying, in addition to Cesar, I really tip my hat to our colleague Adrian Johnson, who we refer to as AJ, because he did a lot of the legwork to bring this collection to the Benson Latin American collection. And I don't want to speak for him. He is the person in charge of Caribbean collections there, but I would go so far to say as this is the most notable Caribbean archival collection that we have at the Benson. So it's a big deal. It's a big time acquisition. It is a collection of 15 boxes, and its holdings are correspondence among many of the great writers in this Ordígenes group, and outside of that as well. Documents written by Diego, manuscripts, poetry, César referenced lecture notes, additional notes. Within the collection as well are documents written by other notable writers, manuscripts, poetry. There's photos, there's printed materials and audiovisual materials as well. So it's a really robust collection that works across different formats, different sort of thematic content. And that makes for a really nice and large scope.
So César, I think besides the archivist who is in charge of processing the collection, you are one of the people who is most familiar with it. So what can you tell us about it?
Well, I agree that it's the most important Caribbean collection we have, and it has materials by Eliseo, it has manuscripts by Eliseo, it has Eliseo. It represents Eliseo on his many capacities as a poet, as a translator, as a teacher, as a specialist in children's literature. It has a very plentiful epistolary, and both with members of the Ordígenes group and with people that he was corresponding, especially, in his different official capacities. The material sort of when he was working on the with Nicolás Guillén in this outreach to Soviet poets, it's very rich and it's unread, right? But the other gift that we have with the Eliseo Diego collection is that it's also a family archive, and this is something that is just unique and it's just stunning to see. Because it's not only the materials of Eliseo Diego, it is also the archive of his children. And all three of his children are very accomplished Cuban cultural figures. No? Eliseo Diego, his second son, who is one of the most important writers of his generation, an important novelist, a very crucial essayist, and also a teacher of film of film writing. He's one of the most renowned scriptwriters in Cuba's film industry. And we have scripts by Eliseo Alberto. We have manuscript by Eliseo Alberto. We have correspondence with his father, with Eliseo Alberto. Eliseo Alberto, he died early because of liver problems. It was riñones. Those are kidney problems. And his posthumous novel, La Novela de Mi Padre, right, is actually written as the family was sort of making a decision about how to organize the papers. And essentially it's about a manuscript that we have, which was the novel that the beginnings of the novel, the finished novel that Lezama was asking Eliseo to write. And he actually says, this is my version of the novel that my father first started to write. So one of the things that I want to do is actually sort of see how he researched, how he used the documents, because one of the things that is part of this novel, of Eliseo's posthumous novel, is that he draws from the letters that Eliseo and Bella, his wife, wrote when they were apart, when he was doing his MA in New England. And a lot of those, letters by Bella especially, who was, Bella was a sister of arguably the best women poet in the language living today. So, of course, her family was a family of great musicians, very recognized in Cuba. So the letters of Bella, the way that her son rescues them, and the dynamic, the poiesis, just the poetry of them addressing each other, right? It makes us recover Bella, who all her letters to Diego, to Eliseo Diego, are at the Benson. So it's not just Eliseo Diego. We are sort of getting a whole family that is foundational. Especially in the transitional history from from the Republic to the Revolution, right? Fefe, very important specialist in children's literature and a writer in her own. Rappi, Constante Diego, who was perhaps the most important children's illustrator of his generation. And we have a lot of his drawings, right, are part of the collection. So just, you know, this is basically the portrait of the family. Wow. in an archive at UT Benson, which actually can allow us to really innovative new ways of being able to approach cultural production in terms of how the family as an institution is challenged, but prevails. No, the question of that sustainability is something that is part of the very architecture of the Eliseo Diego papers.
So, what about you, Daniel? What have you discovered or seen in the collection?
To me, the big win here was the Nicolás Guillén materials, which include letters and poems dedicated to Eliseo Diego. When I was a student, I had a professor at the University of New Mexico who assigned us Guillén's poetry, starting with, I believe, El Gran Zoo. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those moments, you know, I admitted earlier, I struggled a bit with Les Amas Limas Paradiso, but with Guillén, there was something that just clicked for me. And it was one of those moments that changed my life, which is the beauty of literature, I think, that it can do that. And so from that day on, I really began to focus more and more on Afro-Latin American literature. So to have in my hands Songoro Kosongo, handwritten by Guillén, handwritten, it really gave me chills. And I think, you know, I talk about the beauty of literature and what it can do, the beauty of the archive and getting in there and having that sort of emotional reaction to it, sure, which I see with other scholars that are in the Benson too. I mean, it's just a wonderful thing to experience and to participate in. So that's what comes to mind when you ask me that question, Pilar.
Mm. One thing that I'll say, I mean, yeah. I'm also very impressed with that particular part of the collection, the exchanges between Nicolás Guillén and Eliseo Diego. They respected each other tremendously. And Nicolás Guillén also was very very close to Cintio and to Lezama. He was a welcoming figure. He was caught against the sword entre la pared y la espada y la pared in some moments, right? But where you actually had commissars sort of try to take over the Unión, etc. But he did his best to protect the Orígenes group members, and his exchanges with Eliseo are full of humor. They had a lot of the very style, right? The sense of the economy of the poetry, even the orality. Eliseo wanted a poem that could be recited. Right, it had a sort of a liturgical aspect to it, but he wanted he moved away from doing elaborate forms of poetry. You know, he there's no hiperbaton, all that sort of baroque play with syntax, that's not in Eliseo. So they wanted a poetry that could reach to the widest audience, sure, and that he shared with Nicolás, and the cordiality of the one of the things that they that's part of the of the exchanges is that they actually wrote they drew caricatures of each other. They dealt with this visual aspect, which is something, you know, sort of like the concrete poetry, right? That's something that they, you know, the both were very attentive to writing out their poems, to really creating manuscripts that sort of had an aesthetic sort of presentation to it. And one of the things that one of the last things is that when Nicolás Guillén wrote his poetry for children, He only wanted Rappi Diego to illustrate them. Oh, okay. So the books for children written by Nicolás Guillén are illustrated by Eliseo Diego's son.
Wow, incredible. And another thing I wanted to ask you is about the colloquium that was organized to commemorate the acquisition. And César, I know you work with our colleague AJ, who Daniel mentioned in an earlier intervention, to have this colloquium in November 2021. Can you tell us a little bit about the colloquium, how it went, what was the content?
Well, let me say that the colloquium was a miracle. And I'm not saying that from a religious point of view. I'm saying that from a very secular point of view. And part of it, I mean, it took time to put together, and we were able to invite some of the most important specialists in the work of Eliseo Diego. There was a very important participation of Mexican scholars, but we actually had people from Chile, we have people from Spain, we have people from Cuba. And the miracle is having people from Cuba, being able to find the people, be able to go beyond the firewalls, be able to coordinate sort of people there, to be able to be part of that conversation, and to have a colloquium that will be open to all stakeholders in the study of Orígenes, and making sure, and of Eliseo Diego, of course, but, you know, first of Eliseo Diego and then Orígenes, and being able to accomplish something that could be, had an openness so that everybody was welcomed, you know, in the context of so many barriers, right, that we're seeing, and of a world that is becoming more and more fractured by the minute. So that's why, you know, when we conceived and we thought about bringing people together, we wanted to actually have some of the best literary critics who had written about Eliseo come from, be from Cuba, and we were able to incorporate Roberto Méndez, one of the top critics in Cuba, you know, really, really a supreme erudite scholar, and Yvette Fuentes, who's also has two books on Eliseo Diego, and many other people that were able to join us. We are very sad that one of Cuba's top scholars, a dear friend, Enrique Sainz, was who actually perhaps is the most outstanding critic and reader of poetry in Cuba, or was, because he passed away 2 weeks ago. By the time of when we organized had the colloquium last year, we were counting on his participation. But at the time, he was already in a home. It was very difficult to reach him, so we didn't count with his voice then. Right then, you know, I take the opportunity to acknowledge the foundational role of Enrique Sainz as one of Cuba's most eminent readers of poetry, a great friend of the Orígenes Circle, but and somebody that actually, you know, he was sort of like the guardian angel of the conference. Without the example set by Enrique Sainz, there wouldn't have been the Eliseo Diego conference. And we were sad that we couldn't actually bring him in, but we were able to have other Cuban specialists be part of the mix.
Well, it was a very successful conference. Is it online? Was it possible?
Yes, it was recorded. It's online.
Okay.
We have people in Cuba saw it. People everywhere saw it.
Wonderful.
So the question of access was something that was important to us. So we actually recorded it, and it's available in the through the Benson Collection Facebook page.
Perfect. We'll post a link so people can access it when we post the interview. And just to finalize this fascinating interview, I really learned a lot of things today. I wanted to ask you if you want to share anything else. You have talked about what projects you have to incorporate the collection into your work. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that to end the episode?
I have a paper on Eliseo Diego and Reinaldo Arenas. I have a paper about Eliseo Alberto's novel, about his father's unfinished novel, which I want to actually see what letters by his mother he literally transcribed and what letters by his mother he invented. So that will be that's another paper. But the one of the things that. I'm not sure to what extent this could be something that can be presented in a paper, but the history of this archive is really interesting, and I spoke about the family as an institution of sustainability, of cultural sustainability against all odds. Because the family history has been a very challenge. History, right? Like every, you know, family in Cuba, right? With the embargo, with polarizations. Just think about the situation now and the way in which you actually have, you know, artists sort of being criminalized at this moment. That, you know, it's not to say that it comes and goes. The question of free artistic expression, you know, everywhere. It's still unresolved. It's not just Cuba that sort of needs to be pointed out for sure. We can talk about that even here, at this very moment in this country itself. But the thing about being able to maintain an archive, right, in those contexts, and the question of family devotion within all the conflicts that are within a family itself, and how that. Is a question of survival and how archives have these scars and how archives really have there's a hurt there, right? Basically, you know, the miracle of those materials being able to reach us and who invested in accomplishing that miracle so that these materials survive. This is something that you see in the materials itself. One of the things that you have in this collection, you have all these photocopies of some materials because you know how expensive photocopies are in Cuba. You know, to be able to actually just use that in order to preserve a material that is about to become, you know, to disappear because it's about to burst into nothingness, ¿no? Está a punto de pulverizarse. It's almost about to be pulverized. And sort of being able to just get that photocopy done so that it can be preserved. I mean, just thinking about that effort and to understand that, you know, archives really are survive against all odds, right? And we are in charge of them. The question of their being under our custody, and the sacredness of that custody, I think, is something that it really comes through with all the archives we have at the Benson Collection, but I think especially with the Eliseo Diego Archive.
Well, thank you very much, Cesar, for that reflection about how you'll use the collections and about the importance of archives and our responsibilities as librarians and scholars. To preserve them and also to share with the public this information. So this is the end of our podcast today. And again, Cesar, thank you very much for being so generous with your time and sharing all your knowledge with us today.
No, it's a pleasure. Ha sido un placer.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Un deleite.
Oh, thank you very much, everyone, for tuning in as well. And we hope to see you next time. Benson at 100 is a production of Lilas Benson Latin American Studies and Collections at the University of Texas at Austin. To see relevant images and links for today's discussion, as well as to support the Benson Centennial, visit benson100.org. Music for this podcast was composed by Ola Ola. Thanks for tuning in.